Right now, it is time to travel abroad as we head to Ireland, and it's time for the Media Beat live from Ireland with David Tarachuk. David, of course, has his own website, themediabeat.us. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we say good morning to David. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. I'm glad to be reporting in, as you say, from far away from the media capital of the world, New York City, my usual base. I am in Ireland still, in fact, hoping to bring you European media responses to the news. And I'm glad to be joining Marshall Miles as ever, as you bring up the essential questions of the moment. But just before the news, I've got to send you just a little belated Thanksgiving wish, Marshall, hoping you had a good one. Ireland, of course. Tell me, did you have a good one?
Had a good one, and of course, you didn't celebrate over there, or did you?
No, that's the point. I mean, Ireland does not celebrate this holiday any more than anywhere else outside North America. But the inevitable media observation to make is that the indelible imprint of America upon commerce is truly international. And it's very telling to report, I think, that even with no Thanksgiving here in Ireland, we do nonetheless have Black Friday today. And Cyber Monday's price-slashing sales after the weekend. The tentacles of U.S. business practice do reach into everywhere, it seems.
Well, especially, I think, isn't Amazon and all its headquarters located over there?
Oh, very big media presence, tech media, certainly. And what we used to call new media, it's no longer all that new. There's very considerable presence. Google, Amazon, Twitter, lots of high-tech firms have their European headquarters here. The one aspect of American life, just to turn somber for a minute, Marshall, is that the Irish and all of Europe and wider than that, I'd say, are thankful for not having this particular aspect of American life, the endless epidemic of mass fatal shootings. The same old reaction of horror and utter bewilderment that the epidemic continues to go on, is now resounding throughout European media in reaction to those three massacres by bullet within days of each other back in the States, in the Walmart store in Chesapeake, Virginia, the LBGQT nightclub in Colorado Springs, and in the previous week on the University of Virginia's campus. I noticed that on CNN International, which broadcasts here, of course, broadcasts everywhere, the frequent assessment is again being voiced that America's relationship to guns is unique in the world, and that America is a global outlier for its gun culture. But European and British commentators both have been pointing out that even other countries where guns have been a big part of the culture, South Africa, for instance, where for decades guns were hugely important to the ruling white population. I reported a lot on that in my time. Gun-related deaths have been actually nearly halved over the last 10 years after the enactment of a Firearms Control Act about 16 years ago. And New Zealand, which in some sense is a bit like the U.S., has had a kind of frontier experience and formative European settlement since its early founding, endured a huge mass killing of 51 people at once at a mosque in 2019, you may remember. And they almost instantly, by an almost unanimous vote in their national legislature, passed laws that completely banned semi-automatic assault weapons. So, you know, America isn't quite so different, and you know, other countries deal with it differently, even though they have similarities with the States. It's worth noting that worldwide, very few countries have a similar constitutional protection like America's for private citizens to carry arms. In fact, you know, I've been doing a survey, thanks to all this media coverage at the moment, of other countries' constitutional practice. And in fact, there's only Mexico and Guatemala that have that constitutional protection for private citizens bearing arms. That's very interesting company for the United States to be keeping. And there's, of course, the unavoidable overall fact of the sheer mass of private gun ownership in the U.S. Americans make up about 4.4% of the global population, the entire population of the world, but we own 42% of the world's guns. And the only country that comes anywhere close to us in gun ownership per head is, interestingly, Yemen in the Middle East. And even there, they're a long way behind, 60 guns per 100 people, while in the U.S. it's almost 90 guns per 100 people. So that's what the reaction is in Europe and the rest of the world.
You know, it's amazing when you look at figures like that. I know, you know, people say, you know, liar, your numbers lie and stuff like that. But certain numbers don't tell the whole story, but they tell a large story. And just that number alone, it just almost leaves you with your jaw dropped to the floor.
Here in the what are called the British Isles, although Ireland doesn't like the two islands being both labeled with the other country's name, but I know that you're very interested in the United Kingdom's danger, if you like, or the potential for it to break apart these days. And while it's been an interesting week of news for you, there's been some severe cranking up of tension on that front. This week, after the United Kingdom, which has a Supreme Court nowadays, it's not all that old. It began during the Labour government of Tony Blair, and it now has a Supreme Court somewhat modelled on the United States Supreme Court. It sits in London, of course, but it passed a judgment telling the Scottish National Party, in power now in Scotland for 11 years, running successively, never out of office for 11 years, but it's been told by the Supreme Court that it does not have the authority to call a new referendum on Scottish independence, the exit, in other words, from the Union, that is the United Kingdom. The UK has included Scotland since 1707 and the so-called Act of Union of that year. You'll remember that the last referendum on this issue 8 years ago was a disappointment to the Scottish Nationalists, and they failed to get a majority for independence then. But a snap poll held in Scotland this week in reaction to the Supreme Court judgment, conducted under the auspices of a TV network, one that I used to work for, in fact, found that now 50% of the Scots would vote for the SNP, the Scottish Nationalist Party, the next chance they get, if it means they'll be leaving the UK. Those in power in London, of course, remain, the political power, the Prime Minister and the Conservative Party that now is in government. They, of course, remain opposed to the whole idea of Scotland breaking away. But the tension is, as I say, rising. I think one way to guarantee that Scots, or at least a certain kind of Scot, will want their independence passionately is, of course, for the English to tell them that they can't even raise the question among their own people.
I was interested in the response they'll wait for now, but revisit it.
Yeah. And that's a kicking of the can down the road, yeah, which doesn't go well with the fervent Scottish nationalists. The fire has been stoked. I think that the power of that, I mean, you know, we can take our various differing views about the value of public opinion polls, but it's one thing to ask people what their opinion might be at this moment in a poll, but it might be very different from the way they actually vote. But it's an interesting that the leap in interest, let's put it at that in that mild word, interest in having a government which is committed to leaving the Union of the United Kingdom. It's very interesting. But it's still, as I say, balanced half and half. 50% says that opinion poll. Again, in one of those priceless journalistic phrases, only time will tell what the actual outcome is going to be.
Well, don't you think that...
But can we talk about the Men's Soccer World Cup?
Well,
because it's a big story here, even if it might not be in the States.
Well, it was a big story here in the States, but the stupid thing about it was there was a whole bunch of stories written about how you couldn't have beer at the games.
Yes, of course. It's an Islamic country. Yeah. Are we surprised at that? A little difficulty over alcohol?
Now, thank God after that, they're covering the soccer, but yeah, it's the first time in an Islamic state has held the games.
It is indeed, and the interesting background story as to how they got it. I mean, everyone knows that FIFA, the international ruling body of what they call association football, which is where we get our word soccer from, is not the cleanest of official bodies, let's put it that way. And Qatar is one of the richest nations in the world, so that may just possibly have something to do with it. Here in Ireland, there's been some effort at a boycott of the global event, watching it on TV, I mean, in particular. And that of course, is moral outrage at the host country. Qatar's abysmal human rights record, rather. But it seems like the sheer love of soccer, football, as they call it here, is outweighing that outrage, and viewers are now tuning in vast numbers as we're now almost a week into the tournament. And spunkily, I can say, the Irish national broadcaster, RTE, has been ignoring the angry orders issued by Qatar itself and the organizers, FIFA, and the Irish broadcasters have been pointing out all the political questions raised, as well as reporting on and analyzing the actual games on the field. RTE drew attention, for instance, to the way that the Iranian team declined to sing their own national anthem at the start of their first match against England. It was a significant protest against their oppressive government back home, and quite a risk for those players to take. But the interesting thing is, or one interesting thing is, that for many people back home in Iran, it wasn't enough. In the next match, that only just ended an hour or so ago, the whole team was singing, but with, and I'll quote here, varying levels of enthusiasm, quoting the originally Qatari TV network itself, Al Jazeera, which in the international field anyway is sometimes surprisingly independent. That change in the players' behavior around the national anthem, we can only assume is the result of great pressure being brought to bear on the players. The fact is, it must be among the worst news to report in the world at the moment, and among the most difficult news to report on in light of the state control of the Iranian media that there is. But Iran's horrific clampdown on its own protesting population, something like 14,000 people have now been arrested for these largely women-led protests that are being held. Many hundreds of people killed in the streets, and now scores of people being sentenced to death in so-called trials, trials under the control of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, of course. It's classic despotism. No wonder the most resounding chant in the streets is death to the dictator. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, an extraordinary upsurge of condemnation for the highest authority in the land. That's what he is. And it's all very redolent of the vigorous protest movement in 2019 that was violently crushed then. And this time, the regime has been slower to calm down, but now that it's happening, it's every bit as vicious. But this current protest has now lasted 7 whole weeks, keeps going on. Quite extraordinary, and of course, astonishingly brave. I mean, thanks to some probing journalistic work, perhaps mostly the BBC's Persian service, so they're all speaking Farsi or Persian, and we're learning from them more directly. about the families of those being subjected to the Ayatollah's abuse of power, the way especially that the courts are a sick mockery of justice, really, with the accused being denied all rights of due process, often without any legal representation at all. The BBC has also been instrumental in revealing to us how disappointed the protesters inside Iran are with their World Cup team, actually booing them. And this is an extraordinary thing in a football match, a soccer match, cheering on their opponents. And we've yet to hear how the Iranian people have reacted to today's match with Wales, which incidentally Iran just won. But the ominous news just an hour or so ago out of Iran is that authorities have arrested the nationally famous soccer player Boria Ghafouri. He's a retired star who's been active in the protests. He's been charged with propaganda against the Islamic Republic and, quoting the charge again, insulting and undermining the Iranian national football team. You know, and in terms of the rest of the world, their relations with this oppressive Iranian regime, well, in the just the past few days, Iran has told international inspectors that it plans to begin making nearly bomb-grade nuclear fuel. And they'll do this deep inside a mountain that's hard to bomb. And they're also going to dramatically expand their nuclear fuel production at a plant that both the U.S. and Israel have repeatedly sabotaged in the past. I think they're more wise. They have wised up a bit to the risks of sabotage, and they're going ahead. So in response, we hear that the Biden administration it's now letting it be known to the International Press Corps that it's in process of preparing a whole new approach to Iran. The unspoken corollary, so far at least, being that the U.S. will now be abandoning its recent attempts to revive the previous global deal with Iran, that multinational so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan, if you recall, which was pretty well dismantled by the Trump administration pulling out of it in 2018. So what, I think I have to reflect what new and different kinds of pressure America could possibly enact against Iran now is a conundrum in search of a solution. Let's hope that journalists covering the State Department and the White House will be pressing for answers there.
You know, when you talked about the World Cup, something very interesting has happened on TV around here. Saudi Arabia is running just an amazing amount of commercials about tourism and how they welcome visitors with open arms to come to Saudi Arabia. It's just something I noted that I had never seen so many commercials touting Saudi Arabia, but it's all tied around the World Cup.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's an opportunity for, for Qatar itself to boast its own attractiveness to visitors from overseas. Not, of course, people who might want to go and work there. We were talking last week of the appalling record of the Qatari construction industry that built the stadiums for this current extravaganza. The shockingly high number of deaths suffered by these workers who are mainly drawn from South Asia. Some visitors are welcome, are made welcome, the ones with money. And the same is probably true of Saudi Arabia. Under the appalling crown prince there, who has a track record of murder and in particular the murder of one journalist that we've talked a lot about in our show here. They have an appalling record in human rights. But under that same vicious, I'd say, crown prince, they are desperately trying to modernize. And one of the ways that they're going to do that is shift their economy from a total dependence upon oil and oil and petroleum-related products coming out of Saudi Arabia. They want to boost the tourism industry. If I were a little more kindly disposed towards this regime, I'd say good luck with that. but it's very telling that, of course, what they're going to do is do what they do best, which is spend a lot of money to improve their position in the world, sometimes by a form of financial blackmail, which is what limiting their output of oil, which is so important to the world's economy, and other times by just spending like in the old British phrase, a drunken sailor, to get a better press, if you like, in the West. The amount of money that they spend on lobbying companies in Washington, for, companies that do lobbying in Washington, is extraordinary, and it's an inevitable matter of a country wanting to get its reputation improved against all terrible odds, I have to say. But often, you know, rather like we've been hinting at other points in today's coverage of World Cup, it's money that counts in the end, or can be.
And one final note. Yesterday, a brand new law went into effect in New York State, and that is the New York Victim Survivor Law. And the first person who has been charged in that, since that law goes into effect yesterday, Donald Trump.
the one individual which I think is probably, well, it's, we don't want to prejudice any no. court proceedings, but it seems like a good fit. Let's put it that way. Former President Trump, already accused of rape, of this this individual woman who, you know, bravely brought the subject up, and he put it into the legal a legal framework in the first place anyway by allegedly slandering her, and now that's so far that's been the nature of the legal contest. But now, very straightforwardly, thanks to this change and updating of laws so that retrospective cases can be pursued back over a long period of time. And in this case, we're talking about the latter part of the last century when this alleged rape took place in the dressing room of a department store in New York City, of all places. But now it's a straightforward and very blunt accusation of rape that our former prime minister, former president, has got to face. Things are getting very, very difficult for Mr. Trump in his retirement, and as he now works out quite how to pursue this campaign that he's just only recently declared for the 2024 presidential run.
And, of course, joining Donald Trump in running for president, Kanye West announced his presidential bid.
Well, I'll use that phrase again. Good luck with that.
All right. So we'll hear from you next week once again from Ireland.
I think I may well be in a different country in Europe next week, but I'll keep you posted about where that's going to be.
Well, have safe travels, David, and we look forward to speaking to you next week.
I look forward to that.
Take care.
Bye now.
David Terechuk, live from Ireland this morning with The Media Beat. You can find David at his own website, which is themediabeat.us. And, of course, David is also on our website, which is robinhoodradio.com. And when you get to robinhoodradio.com, click on demand. And when you get to the on demand page, just do a search for The Media Beat. Or go to the right side, scroll down the column, and you'll find David Terechuk with The Media Beat, all organized there in chronological order.